Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, we have Ken Zonta. Ken joins us to talk about his book, Buffalo Nation, the American Indian Effort to Restore the Bison. Ken is a history instructor at Yakima Valley College in Yakima, Washington, and is the author of articles and the book that we'll be talking about today. And we're having him on to discuss the broader issue of the bison population, the meaning in American Indian culture, and the efforts to restore the population to South Dakota and the Great Plains. Ken, thanks for joining us on History 605.
Ben, thank you very much for having me.
Well, you're welcome. About 4 years ago, I had Andrew Eisenberg come on the show to talk about his book, The Destruction of the Bison. And I came across yours, and it strikes me as adding to that story. I think one that Andrew would appreciate doing, because he lamented when the reissue of his book came out a couple of years ago that if there was work to be done, it was kind of on the backside since the 1880s, 1890s, on how the population has created has reestablished itself. So I appreciated getting into your book. I was wondering, how did you get interested in this subject? What drove you to get into this broad debate?
Well, it was kind of an intersection of some forces that are sort of lifelong characterizations of me. I'm interested in nature, and I've been interested in Native American or Indian culture since I can remember. And so also I'm an outdoor person. So I paid attention to kind of the outdoors, and as I started working on things academically with this or the material, the kind of what Peter Mathiasen, the author, called the Age of Annihilation, it presents itself foremost, and I think most of us are familiar with, there were a lot of buffalo and then there weren't very many. And so we have this story of this slaughter, and it's true with other animals as well, including antelope and elk, and obviously the grizzly out on the plains and such. So I was interested in that, and then I studied that a little further and noticed sort of as kind of an afterword in some of these books, say on the buffalo, some of the classics like Dairies or Hughes or something, that they'd have this, and there a few were brought back. And so I just really wanted to explore the bringing back of the bison. And as I got into that in more detail, I saw, well, there's quite a story here of Native American people bringing the buffalo back that sometimes would be overlooked or mischaracterized. And then within that, I saw another sub-story there of Native American women in particular being leaders in this effort as well. So that intrigued me enough to pursue it further. And that led me to ultimately, to my academic work, a master's thesis, and an article or two, and then ultimately my book as I continue to explore the subject.
Well, it's great. I think you raised that issues. And your first chapter there is very helpful to me in understanding the nature of the argument, or something we would call inside the history business, the historiography, right? Story about all the stories and how all that is brought together. I wanted to kind of get into that issue. And before the kind of the dramatic decline of the population in the 1870s and 80s, there's dramatic declines of other populations. And you go all the way back to the tail end of the Ice Age and talk about the decline of other populations. There used to be, mammoths and huge bears and horses and all these things that were native to North America that became extinct for reasons that are widely debated. And you get into some of that in your book. I was wondering if you could maybe talk about all of that. How is the ecology, the environment impacting the population of those species as well as the bison species 20,000 years ago.
Right. So as you said, there is some argument about, you know, about what happened to those Ice Age megafauna, you know, these large animals. And it kind of comes down to labels there, the overkill versus overchill theories. And the overkill theorists argue that essentially as the Paleo-Americans or Paleo-Indians arrived on the scene, that those big animals were killed off for the most part, including a larger bison that's probably about a quarter larger than the bison that we know today. And that theory is pretty simple. It hinges on the fact that so that as we found these remains, we found evidence, including spear points and a lot of dart points that for arrow points in the remains. So analysts would say, well, so clearly these were impacted by humans or killed by them and butchered by them. And so they went on to say, and about the time the population started to increase here, those animal populations met their demise for the most part, with some hanging on and surviving, including the buffalo. And I'll quickly, won't be too much of an aside, but in some of the Native American and First Nations, Canadian as well, there was a bit of an agreement reached between the bison and the indigenous people that, you know, we won't fight you if, you know, if you, we kind of can coexist, so to speak. And it would perhaps a conservation biologist would say this kind of explains the difference between the bison, the larger bison that would kind of stand and fight. And you really would not stand a chance against a group of organized humans. And there is no question here whether it's overkill or overchill. The capacity of humans to kill is great. So the way that story works is that so we'll reach this agreement. And then, of course, the bison, we think of as the plains bison, they won't really stand and fight. They'll move and run and do herd defenses. And so that makes them less vulnerable to human predation that way. Now, the other side of this is the overchill, and this is based on climate change, saying that essentially the kind of what I refer to as sort of a cold savanna, or in some folks we call it kind of this Beringian steppe, this cold savanna. And you know, as a teacher or instructor, professor, you're often dealing with people who are versed in the Lion King. So you're trying to somehow make this like something they can relate to. So you say, you know, yeah, about Simba and the Lion King. So that's a savanna. All right. That's what it looks like, assuming they're not watching nature programming or something. And so now you put that in a cold climate and you have some of these other animals that are sort of similar, like you see an elephant and there's a mammoth and there's some bigger animals. And so, but the bottom line is that landscape is very rich nutrition for it. And it's referred to by like Dale Guthrie in Alaska, who's talked about this sort of this plaid landscape of forest, grassland, shrubland, it's all mixed. Mm-hmm. Was the climate change, you had increased heat in the summer and cold. It's had these kind of longer, more extreme seasons. And so this impacted the vegetation. So then you got more of a striped landscape, which is what you see in places like here in Washington where I live. It's very distinct. So I live in Yakima, and as you're moving to a White Pass in the Cascades, you're out here in kind of this shrub steppe, and then you start getting this kind of oak scrub area, and then you're up in the evergreen forest. But that is not nutritionally rich like that plaid landscape. And so what happened was these big animals with long gestation periods began to suffer in their capacity to reproduce, largely because this is the reduced forage. And of course, once you lose the primary producers or the herbivores, and the carnivores follow shortly thereafter. And so the overchill theorists would say, so the arrival of the humans there or the increase in the human populations around those animals was coincidental to what was going on with overchill. So meaning that the climate had changed and there's less nutritious forage. And then at that point, then we change in our fauna. And so there are a few remaining megafauna, and kind of the measures about 2,000 pounds, about a ton. And a big buffalo, you know, a real big buffalo would reach that. Moose would come close. That explains kind of this change from the Ice Age, Pleistocene come Holocene come late Ice Age megafauna down to more what we would know if we, say, picked up Lewis and Clark's journal and read that and saw what they were observing.
Well, yeah, by the time they get there, they're 1804, things have changed rapidly in North America in the last 50 years prior to that. There's comments about it in your book, and I've seen elsewhere that there's buffalo in West Virginia, what is today West Virginia, Southern Georgia, New Mexico, these kinds of places that that Lewis and Clark might have been aware of, perhaps, but so they would have seen that change even at the time. Do you know how they would have explained the shrinkage of the herd onto the Great Plains? Or have they thought about that? Is there any evidence of them thinking about the declining populations in 1804? Because they talk about how huge the herds are all the time.
And I'm not sure how much what we kind of guess would call meta-awareness they had like that, except for they would, you know, in terms of it as observation, they would document where they saw greater densities. Mm-hmm. So I don't know that they would say Lewis and Clark. I mean, Lewis got to be fairly scientific-minded, and Clark did too, but would have made it kind of theorize, like, so why are we not seeing as much? Certainly they would understand hunting pressure and realize that in a place like Kentucky, I wouldn't quite call it a refuge, but this place where animals were doing quite well and sort of this marginal hunting ground between various nations, Indian nations, that there was a larger population of those diminished or decreased. So, and they probably would have had a sense too that the animals are trying to stay away from people, you know, although what they're finding is not highly skittish animals as they come across the plains and into the mountains.
Right. Well, what is it about the bison, or what we call the buffalo, or what Lewis and Clark would have called the buffalo, that kind of helps them weather, no pun intended, the shifting climate? Because you spent some time in your book talking about their grazing habits, their ruminants, the grasses, and their speed all kind of help them out. I wonder if you draw some conclusions based or describe some of those things and then explain how that all led to their survival, as opposed to being killed off like the mammoth or something.
Right. Yeah, it is. In fact, so when you look at the bison and the, you know, the surviving bison that came out of the ice age, so they are a herd animal, and there's a dynamic within herd animals to protect themselves, utilizing basically the physics of the herd. Okay, so you kind of blend in, disappear, and of course the predators like the wolf that were always attendant, they quickly figure out which ones can't hang with the rest, so to speak, you know, and so they're always trimming the herd, and there's this ancient relationship that seemed to work well for both of them, but this ability to move and not stay in fight like some of those big animals had really helped them. The one difficult thing for the bison is once, of course, indigenous people figured out that there are ways to manipulate those herds. And so you could have mass harvest that way. And I really would take exception to someone saying that this led in any way, shape, or form to extinction or extirpation, meaning a localized extinction, because you go to a place like many buffalo jumps, but someplace like Head Smashed Inn in Alberta, you're looking at places that are sustainably harvested for 6,000 years. You know, you're hard pressed to find much of any place in the world where there's resources utilized heavily for 6,000 years continuously. So I just wanted to make sure that's kind of clear. So as the bison evolved and they have these defensive strategies, and native people figured out how to overcome some of those defensive strategies, that there did seem to be a fairly symbiotic and kind of a mutually beneficial relationship, and certainly in the native cosmology be a respectful relationship as well. But the bison then, which you look at with like a large bison herd, they're matriarchal, and you're seeing a collection of basically families led by a female, and then they would amalgamate and create these larger herds that you know, Western observers had documented, or people have talked about that were there. So again, it is that don't stay and fight, but move and keep moving. Uh-huh. And that is what keeps the, you know, allows the bison to generate. And those populations in terms of where they are, very fluid. So for example, here in the state of Washington, one of our Yakima archaeologists, he goes, I've seen on a map, they said they're in Washington. But we don't really feel that way, and understandably, but we have found Clovis points here with bison blood on them. So, and that's why a map might show that they're here. But in terms of something like the plains bison, something like you'd have in the Dakotas or South Dakota, no, you would not have seen that here. But a few moving in and out of the river valleys along the Snake Plain or something, that probably would account for, you know, them being on a map, someone saying that they were in the present state of Washington at that time, but certainly not in the large plains populations. And those populations in those valleys, as they'd move in and out on those, you know, not larger plains areas, were pretty vulnerable to human predation, just because, you know, you start getting a salmon country, you get a heavy density of humans in a given area, and humans are good hunters.
Even before the horse. I was wondering, it might be interesting for you to describe how would, and the place where that that location in Canada that you describe in the book, the head smashed in, is that
right,
the name
head smashed
of it?
In.
Yeah.
Yes.
Where they killed, there was a killing zone over, they rode him over a cliff. I wonder if you could describe the organization of how a group of people would do that, and just maybe take some minutes here to, how would all that happen and come to pass? What are the different tools they would use, and how do they kind of drive the bison off the cliff? It's not just a pickup game, right?
That's correct. Yeah. So this is where we start flirting with this concept that's not new anymore, but indigenous science. So, you know, this is an empirical observation on bison, and then also a kind of a spiritual angle as well that the native people took to try to identify with bison, think like bison, and combine that with the observation. So essentially what something like a buffalo jump would be is, first you find a location. A location have to be something where there's a cliff. It doesn't have to be extremely tall. So there's a cliff, and somehow you've got to, you know, the native people, they have to manipulate the bison to run over that. Now, the mechanics of the herd, as I said, using the physics for a defense, that means they're going to run, and they're going to run as a group and keep running, and that's their protection, but it also can be lethality for them in this case. So what would happen would be the people would find a way to infiltrate the herd, so to speak. In other words, get close enough to get into the behavioral interaction. Okay, so you'd have somebody who'd kind of lure them and get them moving in a direction toward this cliff. And then you'd have other people farther out, almost like a big funnel, if you will, just to scare, you know, keep the bison kind of scared and moving that way, you know, moving away from the people and moving toward where the buffalo runner, the bison runner was leading them toward the cliff. And so the bison would get going in this bit of a stampede as which would normally protect them, but in this case they're going toward this cliff. And then of course the bison runner would move off to the side or down or something before they got there, and then these buffalo would then continue to run over the cliff. So and it would not be a pretty picture there at all, but it was a way of harvesting an incredible amount of nutrition, and the native people would do everything they could to utilize everything they, you know, they possibly could. And those attendant wolves we've been talking about probably were hanging around too and trying to get some scraps as well. So it's really quite a bada community event when something like that would happen. And again, for the buffalo, this appears to have been quite sustainable over time, just given the amount of time that these buffalo jumps or bison jumps were used.
So you describe this through the kind of American Indian passed down of history and the oral tradition of describing this, that some wisdom had come to them between not only the kind of the process of doing this, but doing it in conversation with the herd. I wonder if you can go into that a little bit more.
Well, and that is something even in bison recovery that is, I wouldn't say it's unique to the native effort here, but it is something that the bison are part of a conversation. And you see that in the interaction. And that's not to mean that the bison weren't killed at all, because that's part of what the base of the relationship is bison can take that grass that you and I really can't do much with in terms of nutrition, and they turn that into something we can do a lot with, which is the meat. And so there's this relationship that's established in really trying to, for the native people to be brethren, if you will, with the buffalo, so that they could interact with it as fully as possible. And it's, you're really hard pressed to find a relationship between humans and animals, especially one that's not a domesticated animal, that's as thorough as that of the Native people and the buffalo, to be certain. And so this idea that there's part of the cosmology or the worldview or the spirituality, very important. And then that puts a correct frame of mind, and it also influences the interaction of the Native people when they would then go to harvest the resource.
Yeah.
And so there's quite a lot of knowledge there, but also quite a lot of awareness as well. And
yeah.
Both kind of in terms of what we call like this indigenous kind of scientific knowledge, but also the spirituality associated with it.
Well, I appreciate it. I think the quote I drew out of the book was turning the energy of forage into energy for humans.
Correct.
If you think about the chain of events that's going on with the bison eating the grass, and then the humans eating the bison, and there's an appreciation for that relationship
right.
that's occurring. That's a part of that conversation. Let's start talking about some key people here as part of the transition from recognizing that, oh my gosh, there's a huge problem with the destruction of the species and what that will mean for those living here, from the American Indians, as well as even players like the United States government, which at first doesn't seem to be able to stop much.
Even encourage it.
Yeah, well, that's mm-hmm. the big debate that, frankly, we've been having as we put we're designing a new museum, and we're trying to get our heads around all the scholarship around the bison population over the millennia and the recovery of the herd, but and all the factors that go into the near destruction of it, and then the rise of the population again, and thinking about that. And so, yeah, that debate, it's what the federal government tries to do. You do note in your book the bill, I think it's 1874, where Congress introduces a bill that, and I've read that bill. It was interestingly phrased. No, it would have made it illegal for a non-Indian to shoot a female bison in the territories, which is the land the federal government still controls. So the state of Texas, the state of Kansas exist at the time the bill was being discussed. Colorado becomes a state in 1876. So there's kind of ever shrinking numbers of where that law would apply, but then ultimately the bill dies. Pocket veto from President Grant.
It would have been something, but
it would have been something. And I think I've done a lot of digging about why did Grant pocket veto that? And I've not come across anything. Have you come across anything about what motivated Grant not to sign the bill, or it just didn't make it out of his inbox, or?
Yeah, it might be one of these Occam's razor type things, right?
Exactly.
Where we have these competing ideas and we just go with the simplest one. I mean,
he's a
general, he's got field commanders, Sherman, Sheridan, right on down to Custer, these people. And they're just thinking of subduing the enemy, and a way to subdue the enemy was to, ensure that you subdue the enemy sustenance, which of course is the bison. So I don't know that we have Grant saying that specifically, but when you add up sort of what was going on, and certainly there's been folks that you've said there's work out there that shows there's ammunition being doled out to buffalo hunters, white or Euro-American buffalo hunters, that there is a concerted effort here to make sure that buffalo is not a viable resource for the, particularly the Plains Indians, to maintain their free way of life.
Yeah. And then Sheridan quotes are kind of all over the map and Dan Flores, you quote him, he's got this great quote in here that about the caring capacity of an environment and how a society or a group of people with a shared culture makes adjustments to live within the caring capacity of its habitat is not only a valid historical question, it may be one of the most salient questions to ask about any culture. And it strikes me that this very point we're trying to debate or discuss, as these two cultures collide, there's really no way to enforce a shared understanding of what the caring capacity might be. In other words, if that law had passed, I don't know how Grant would have enforced it. That's kind of a practical question, and maybe why he just didn't. Who knows? I'm just making stuff up, but
it does move us, if I may, and it segues a little bit. Like, the people that save the bison are folks that established what we call now a captive breeding program. So meaning that they're going to bring in bison and they're going to protect them, and they're going to propagate them, you know, the bison that they have. So, and there's many lenses of looking at this. You know, you could have the political economist say, well, when you get private ownership, that's what makes it work. But when you look at the people that did it, it's largely with a communal sense, okay? Because it seems also like countless stories of people capturing calves over the centuries, actually.
Yeah.
And nothing comes of that. They capture the calves. They sometimes even move them long distances, but they don't survive and become herd. But we have particularly five households. And I use that term household because very often it's the couple that's working at it, not just the man, which folks.
Yeah, and I think that's an important thing. So, proceed. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So we have five households is all that actually captured calves, and that's typically capture them young. It's very difficult to work with adults, especially bison that have been free their whole life. It's not easy to work with them. So
yeah.
We capture the calves, get them contained, and then create these herds out of that. Okay. And of those five households, there are three in the Northern Plains and two in the Southern Plains. And three of the five are native households. Okay. So you have James McKay, who's Métis in Canada. And then we have Sabina and Walking Coyote in Montana. And then, of course, we have the Dupuy there in South Dakota. In the Southern Plains, you have CJ, Charles Jesse, Buffalo Jones, and Charles Goodnight. Now, both those two would be what we call, Anglo, you're American. But the other ones are native households. And then eventually, there's kind of a movement of these herds or parts of these herds or the progeny between these various groups. And as the government begins to do some protection, say like in Yellowstone or something, then you get some movement into there too, or what becomes a national bison range, which ultimately had been the progeny of those calves captured by San Juan Coyote and Sabina in Montana. And then certainly with the Dupuy bison, eventually they end up with Scotty Phillip, and they become part of the Theodore Roosevelt Parks and also Custer State Park. And there's a lot of propagations taking place out of Custer State Park, over years for sure.
Well, let's talk about the Dupuy, since this is a South Dakota history podcast. Let's focus on that herd. And I've read different accounts about how they, as you mentioned, captured a few calves, and then I think one has them going to Montana to get some bison, and another account shows them capturing calves on what is now Cheyenne River Standing Rock reservations in South Dakota. Have you an opinion about that debate? Or do they bring them in from Montana, or do they capture them local, or to some extent it doesn't matter that much maybe? But
right. Well, it matters, but it doesn't matter. I mean, we don't know for sure. And what matters is the fact that with the Dupuy bison, there's not a lot of dispute when you look at the narratives that are written about it, that the Dupuy family did capture calves and establish a herd. Now, when you get over into Montana, and I'm not going to get down get sidetracked here. There was a lot of conflicting claims about those bison that were established by Walking Coyote and Sabina, and then ended up being part of the Pavel Allard herd. And you don't find that at Dupuy. So it's pretty clear. People accept, these bison were captured by the Dupuy family and then were raised here before they were passed to Scotty Phillips. What matters is that it's a native household. They captured the bison. And there's even debate, did Frederick Dupuy go along or not? Because when Reverend Riggs went with him, he wasn't even there.
Yeah.
Mary Ann Dupuy, or Good Elk Woman, was there. And probably one or more of the sons was there. So so do you give him credit? No, you have to give the family credit, in particular the patriarch and the matriarch, which would be Frederick Dupuy and Mary Ann or Good Elk Woman, the credit for that. They were the ones who provided the aegis, the sponsorship for this, and their family got the calves and brought them back and then grew the herd. The numbers are curious. You said you've read competing stories, and of course there are. Sometimes you see four, sometimes you see nine. And then it looks like there may have been as many as, getting close to 100 about, when they're sold off there. So if we're going from the early 1880s to 1900, so the herd grows. And one thing I've noticed here, Ben, looking at some of these herds that gets not really accounted for, it appears that some of these onesies and twosies calves that we know in the records people would capture here and there, but they never had captive breeding programs. It looks like once in a while some of these calves that just somebody captured would then be brought to an existing herd, like, for example, the Dupuy herd, or in Montana, the Walking Coyote and Sabina herd, and then later the Pablo Allard herd. And so, this is one of those, do I know that this happened with theirs? When you start to look at the numbers, I mean, bison do reproduce pretty well, but it appears there might have been some augmentation elsewhere, and it could have been some of this, somebody else got a calf, and then they just brought him in and either sold them or just gave them, like, here, what am I going to do with this calf? Because you're either going to eat it or, for most people, or do something else with it, like let it go. And so it appears there's maybe some augmentation there. And having said that, that in no way, shape, or form deflects the credit from the Dupuis family, because they're the ones who are running the household, protecting the bison, and growing the herd, which they did.
Describe a little bit about Mary Goodall Woman's motivations and how she understood the buffalo in the way of life of her tribe, because that seems to be, from my reading of your book and other places, that's kind of the major motivation. She's not a Smithsonian naturalist, right? She's from a very different culture, and this is for a very different purpose. So I wonder if you could kind of describe that for a second.
I don't think it's purely coincidence that when you look at bison, they're matriarchal groups. And when you look at, three of these five households are fairly matriarchal groups that save the bison as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that these women, like good elk women, are looking at buffalo and saying those are bison cows, and that's, my relationship here, and they're protectors of their families, and I'm protector of my family. But it does seem to be a connection, and there certainly is a spiritual connection with the lore of Native people with the buffalo calf women and such like that, that there is a bit of a connection. And in her case, these are relatives. Okay. And this is what she's known her whole life. And I imagine that she would not want to let this go. And Jim Garrett, who's a descendant of the Dupuis, has told me, goes, no, one thing you hit on, he said when he's talking about some of the early work he'd seen, is the women, in this case, his grandmother, and he says, we don't do greats and great greats and that. It's just, they're just grandparents. It doesn't,
okay.
We don't get into the gradations like some of us do. But he goes, no, you got that right. I mean, the women really did provide the influence in those households. And so it's would be obvious and necessary to see that she was preserving as much as she could of a way of a life and harvesting of a resource there, and had her family doing this as well. And it seems even in the hunts, as recorded by, say, Reverend Riggs, who went with them in the early 1880s, that she was the one who was really the leader of the expedition.
It's fascinating because it's not the hunt we would see in, say, Dances with Wolves, the movie, right? It's all
right.
Led by the men, and they're going out on horses and, or even the ones that would have taken place before the horse driving them off the cliff, where it was probably a large community affair. This Buffalo Good Elk woman seems to be the prime motivator. And from the quotes I've dug up of Fred Dupree, I don't know, to some degree, he seems to be ambivalent about it. I'm just doing this because the missus says we ought to do it, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I can just kind of see him saying something like that. So
ambivalent and maybe even deferential, right?
Probably a better term. I think he's deferential to his wife. Yeah.
And Basil Clemon, who was also a Métis man at the time, even in I believe was in my book, but he said, this for these men here, the authority they knew were these native wives, these women, that this is who were the agents of change for them. And so he said that. And then Dupuis also said, when they talk about taking land in the allotment, he goes, if she wants to take land allotment, we will. If not, we won't. So clearly, a deference there, too. That's a major issue, too, right? If we're going to get land or not. So
right. It's major lifestyle change, double the size of your place or not to, and all the responsibility that comes to that. Can you talk a little bit about how they would use the bison then as they were trying to grow the herd? Because there's some being slaughtered for food, and they're hosting.
Right.
They're feeding a lot of people. I mean, it's ever-present demand based on the tribe's status and plight in the 1890s and early 20th century.
It appears that these were, there's extended family and probably friends that came to meals regularly. So, so there's, a few people. So this isn't just a single calf or something's going to feed the family. I mean, they're harvesting some buffalo and feeding and doing this quite sustainably because the herd grows. There is some, because very often with these introductory herds or these captive herds, they're mixed with bison and often put on domestic cows for milk originally, of course, because they don't have a bison cow with them. And so you do eventually get some interbreeding And so you get some what historically called the cattle, and some people call it beefalo. What we can deduce with respect to this particular herd is they were not trying to breed a super cow. Now, when you look at, say, Goodnight and Jones in the Southern Plains, they're trying to engineer this, some sort of super cow mix between cattle and buffalo. And this is pretty absent in the Northern Plains efforts, and certainly with the Dupuy family. So we get some cattle in there, but they're not really kept, and by the time Scotty Phillip gets them, when he's harvesting, he pretty much harvests them first, and not in a eugenics way, but just like, we want buffalo, we really don't want hairy cows that are piebald or something like that. That's not really what they're looking for. So it looks like in the case of the Dupuy, what we can deduce is that they were harvesting regularly, but quite sustainably, and then advancing the herd growth as they could. And certainly it's transmitted from this time here in the 1800s all the way to the present, when I did my work with many of the different communities that were bringing back bison. There's always a spiritual aspect to the harvest. It's not, you know, you just go out there and kill one. It's definitely something that's taken very seriously and as a sacred enterprise, and almost that the bison would offer itself, you know. So there's a selection process that I'm sure someone like descendant Jim Garrett could tell you, as he's worked with bison a lot, and he's a Lakota holy man and stuff. He could tell you a little bit more how that process works. But I know certainly even from hunting, the idea would be one will present itself, you know, and that's the one. If you're just going for a single one, that's the one you go for.
Well, by the time they then pass away, how big is the herd? They start with half a dozen or maybe 10 or so, and then when it's sold off, how many are there that go to Scotty Phillip?
Yeah, it's so the best collection, and so quickly we do have, in case somebody thinks, well, how can we possibly know this stuff? Because you get some skeptics out there. So sure. George Bird Grinnell, who's one of the early hunter conservationists and a contemporary of Theodore Roosevelt's stuff, in 1924, he rolled up the origins of all these herds, and he wrote about it. And he was ultimately the editor of Forest and Stream, which became Field and Stream. He's a person in the know. You know, he knew it. So we know the origins of these herds. And using his work, some subsequent historians, Judith Ebring Wood and Marlene Groves, have done some really good work, came out in Wakasosaw about these origins. And it looks like they put the number at 93, but I've seen 98, 100. So it's 90-ish, 100-ish in there. And that's why I say it looks to me like there might have been some augmentation elsewhere besides just those calves themselves, which of course then begs the question, do we have a genetic bottleneck or a problem? Okay. If you just took that herd in isolation, the answer would be yes. But as I said, some of these captive breeders, if you will, they moved bison between these various herds. And so the fact we do have them from different locations in the northern and southern plains has led some of the foremost scientists, most recently, the late Mary Marr, who was kind of the Jane Goodall, and here we're speaking here on Jane Goodall's passed away. She's kind of the Jane Goodall of bison, working with the Yellowstone bison from the 1950s up into around 2000. And I heard her speaking at a bison conference with James Shaw at Oklahoma State, and their conclusion as conservation biologists is we don't really have a genetic bottleneck problem because of this movement between the various herds. So we're looking about a 90, and I'm probably taking this a little farther than maybe you wanted, but 90-ish. And then when Phillip got them, he grew the herd a little bit more, and that's when some of those distributions took place, very importantly into Theodore Roosevelt and Custer State Park, and then ultimately, Wind Cave as well.
The herd in Yellowstone at the time, then what becomes the National Park Service that's managing. Is there crossbreeding between that herd, or what's happened to the descendants of that original herd that the Smithsonian counted at Yellowstone?
Those bison there, and that population got on the verge of extirpation there. I mean, it got one time down to about 2 dozen individuals. So it was just barely hanging on.
Because of the wolves or hunting, or why did it get so low?
So there had been poaching up until they used the army to protect them. And then and then Buffalo Jones became the game warden there eventually. Kind of character from the Southern Plains. he's more story than anything else that we know what he did there. But he's quite a character. But the army protected them. And then it was disease that really – past the poaching that really knocked them down. There's hemorrhagic septicemia. And so they're very, very vulnerable. And of course, Yellowstone's a tough place to live. You know, and if, especially if you can't move in and out of the area. I mean, bison need to move and mm-hmm. take a bite, take a step, take a bite, take a step. And you're trying to go somewhere better. And if you can't, it's really difficult. Mm-hmm. So that population got quite diminished. And then the government, okay, because the National Park Service isn't established yet, but so the government brought in, federal government brought in bison, some from the southern plains, and then a few from some of the northern plains herd. So Charles Goodnight's bison went there. And I believe some of the Pablo Allard herd ended up there as well. And this is where the worry about how much cattle introgression occurred. You know, in there or not. So are there these pure bison? But there appear to be some that were never genetically did have what is called cattle introgression or not. And introgression is kind of a political decision because you can do the markers out to these levels that ultimately somebody has to say, yes, those have cattle introgression or not. And as Dr. Cormac Gates, and who's kind of one of the foremost authorities had been in Canada, said once, I think you got a problem when your buffalo look piebald, but until then it might be okay.
Yeah. But I guess what I'm getting at is, does the Dupuy, Scotty Phillip, Custer State Park herd, as that develops, they seem then to do a better job than the federal government at Yellowstone with their herd. Is that an accurate statement as far as numbers go?
Yeah, that'd be fairly accurate in that herd continued to grow. And then, Scotty Phillip envisioned a bit of a, this kind of this Buffalo Commons idea. And he's not alone in doing this, as did Pablo and Allard, and they're kind of rebuffed on this. And then ultimately, in a way, Custer State Park kind of emerges as this domain where they can roam to some degree that is not just, kind of on a private individual to take care of. Because, of course, you get more and more people and more fences. Yeah. Having bison is more and more problematic. So everybody's running into the same problem, even if you've got a big ranch or a series of ranches, it's difficult because the world's getting kind of parsed out, if you will, into private holdings. And so it's tough to do much. And so you're looking for somewhere, these bison savers are looking for somewhere where the herds can continue to exist beyond just their own pastures, paddocks, and grazing lands.
Let's move the story forward, I guess, up into the 1990s and how your book talks about the Intertribal Bison Cooperative and then how the tribes kind of formally begin, I guess, what we call a modern herd management and development of the herd. What is the IBC and how does that come together?
So if somebody were to look up ITBC right now, they say, well, wait a minute, it says Intertribal ITBC. Buffalo Council, and you said Intertribal Bison Cooperative. Well, it had changed names.
Okay.
But, the initials are the same, so it's just, virtually the same organization in terms of purpose, and that's the idea of bringing the bison back. So prior to 1990s, what you have is a sort of some singular tribal efforts and not getting much support from certainly from the government. So in the assembly there, and of course, South Dakota's very important this because ultimately this is going to be headquartered in Rapid City. What happens is as these groups meet, and a lot of they're organized partly through their various fish and wildlife organizations on the different reservations. And so there's some bison programs, and that's always kind of a thing in Indian country. So are we going to have the fish and wildlife people work with the bison, or is it kind of the livestock people, who's going to work? And it kind of matters how they're treated. But as they got together, the idea was, okay, if we're going to try to get some support from the government here, we need to have a collective voice. And as Fred Dubray, who was one of the original presidents there of the ITBC said, if we just go there and at one tribe at a time and we try to address, say, a congressperson or something, they're just going to shut the door and not hear. So if we're all there together, then they're going to have to listen to us. And so you get, originally a few dozen tribes that are part of the Intertribal Bison Cooperative, and then that grows. I haven't looked at the most recent figure, but it's moved well past the 50s when I was writing and into the 60s. It might be closer to 80 by now. So it's
total tribes that are involved.
Grown. Yeah, quite a lot. And so this is a collective effort, and it's a learning organization, which helps a lot. And that's part of the function is to provide technical support to various reservations around the country. So, for example, the Yakima people here got some ITBC help and some Yellowstone bison not too long ago, and they're very proud of their effort there to be part of this larger Yellowstone effort, and also to work with the ITBC. So it's a collective voice, but also there's a lot of South Dakota voice in that too, and of course the Lakota people in particular.
Just before we started recording, I was telling you I was up on Cheyenne River Reservation a few days ago, and they were commenting about how the herd had grown to a size of 3,000 head. That's just on the reservation. I would say the herd at Custer State Park, of course, gets a lot of attention. We just had the Buffalo right. Roundup. We're recording on the 2nd of October. The Buffalo Roundup was last weekend. Gets lots of attention, and so as it should. The Game Fish and Parks and the Park Service does a great job organizing that. Draws a big crowd, but I think that they probably have 10% of the size of the herd of the Cheyenne River. And I was astounded to hear that number. And it's about the number they've had, I think, for a couple decades now. So clearly, and they serve bison for lunch. It was a wonderful buffalo stew that I had for lunch.
Right.
So the herd there on the reservation, it means a ton to them. I mean, it's just so much a way of life, and they've taken such great pride in bringing that herd back to a meaningful size. And I wonder, maybe in your conversations with the folks that you've mentioned and the descendants of the Dupree family, is 3,000 the carrying capacity of the land they're on, or could they go bigger? What do you think?
Well, so, and you hit the right term there, carrying capacity, and that is the crux of the matter, because what typifies the Native effort, and from, meeting, say, Joseph Dupree and Jim Garrett, both descendants, they would share this view. It's, we want to bring buffalo back to buffalo, and on the terms of the buffalo.
Yeah.
And so the capacity matters, because if you don't have the range land and the land for them to move, then you start to take away what a buffalo is, and to take a bite, take a step, take a bite, take a step, take a... And if you watch buffalo for a while, you think they're not moving. They are moving. And if you try to photograph them, you'll realize how much they're moving, because you're trying to get this perfect shot, and you realize, I just spent an hour, and you swear they didn't go anywhere, but all of a sudden they're 400 yards away or 500 yards away, and you're still sitting there trying to get this picture you never got. So it matters a lot. So as to how much land there is. So somebody, like there was a bit of a hiccup in the Cheyenne River Sioux tribes population there for a while. And what happened was some of their funding for their grazing land fell through. And I saw some analysts interpret this as like they weren't as serious about it as they could be. But a different reading of that would be that, in fact, what they're trying to do is, if we don't have the land, we can't really keep that size of a herd, because then they can't be bison, and so that's always going to be a question, is if you have enough. So I would leave it to the folks on the ground there to decide when enough is enough. But I will say this to your comment, that bison force community cooperation, because they're not easy. And so you have to get a group of people to be committed to this. It doesn't lend itself well to kind of the individualistic kind of low context mainstream society way of going about business. I mean, it really does require people to be cooperative and people to be patient, because they're going to go through, they'll go through a fence if they want, I mean,
you can't
really manage them. You have to manage the people's attitudes around them, really. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of cooperation is really essential with them. And even when you harvest them traditionally, even now, I mean, the idea is somebody's just going to go out there and sort of shoot and butcher a buffalo by themselves without some help, very difficult to pull off. I mean, it's going to take a group of people to organize and pull this off. And that's part of the Dupree family story too, going back.
Right.
It just takes people. And I'm glad to hear their descendants still working on this, because they'll be, invaluable in moving, forward. And someone like Jim Garrett, I mean, he's got a PhD, or certainly an advanced degree in range management. So there's very capable people there that can do this, that very much want to do this in an indigenous relational way, with the bison as in the health of the bison as a fellow species, and down to the individual level, but also the herd level, to be viable and healthy. And that's what they're striving to do. And at no point really do any traditionalists want to see any kind of feedlotting or something like that. That would really not be where we want to go. Although sometimes people have to augment the feeding, because they eat a lot. And so if you don't have enough forage, you may have to supplement feed as well.
Ken, it's been a great conversation, and it's a wonderful book. I think people will really enjoy it for a wide variety of folks who are interested in cattle farming and ranching, mm-hmm. and then also the biology of it, but then also the traditional nature and what it means for bison on the plains and here in South Dakota. So I appreciate your time today, and thanks a lot for the book.
Well, thank you, Ben. I want to say, too, you know, you asked me at the beginning when I worked on this, kind of what I got into. It was never really my story to tell, but nobody was telling the story. I've always thought this is a Native American story. Yep. And since there was a gap there, I thought I would fill it. But it is truly for Native people to continue the story and take it forward.
And they are. I tasted it literally on Tuesday. Right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ben.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruer for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.